This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to Business Masterclass. First half hour is the business skills conversation in association with USB Ed. And last week was about creating a sustainable competitive advantage. What to consider? Interesting conversation. Today, recruitment and remuneration. With me, Richard Angus. Hey, Richard.
How's it, Adrian? How are you doing?
I'm good, man. I'll hand it over to you. Bring our guest in, and who's no stranger. And then we'll have that very important conversation.
Okay. So welcome to Kuma Shongwe, who's joining us in studio again. Kuma, thank you for taking the time to be with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Great. So one of the challenges in any business is finding, recruiting, and then paying the right people. That's always an issue in any business. And I think, you know, given the background of where we're at as a country, I think the fact that we're in Women's Month also drives the question of the whole question being women and men and being compensated equally. So, I guess, a starting point, Kuma, what happens out there in your experience when it comes to, let's call it, women and the recruitment drive? Because I've heard some scary global research. I saw there was one research report that said that it sometimes takes up to 8 phone calls to convince a woman to apply for a job, wherein in fact they say that men are quite happy to take, or probably will give you their CV after 2 phone calls. And this is some research done by a global headhunter. What is your experience in terms of that recruitment space with women getting into the in the workplace and what they're looking for from a recruitment perspective?
Thank you, Richard. I think to a large extent, women will be much more reflective on the jobs that they're taking, because we all know that even though that it is a partnership in terms of parenting, women tend to be the ones that do more of the heavy lifting in terms of their mothering. I'm not suggesting in any way that the fathers are not participant, but we tend to be the ones that think about things like, where do the kids go to nursery school? And then we have conversations with our partners. So obviously one would have to take those things into consideration much more than our male partners would. Mm-hmm. I think it also has to do with the fact that we are, although black economic empowerment, employment equity, and all those issues have been in place for the past many years, there is still an element of women being treated differently. As you rightly say, that the research that was carried by the Norman Broadbent recruitment firm, saying that women take much longer to make the decisions, or it takes 8 phone calls to actually try and attract them to come mm-hmm. into that space versus 2 telephone calls to males who you are trying to recruit.
It kind of sounds like with the men, you phone once, say, would you be interested, phone a second time and say, come on, dude, let's talk, and the men are game for any opportunity, whereas women reflect a lot deeper and think about all of the issues. What are some of the things that women would consider in that recruitment process that perhaps we wouldn't see in let's call it the male-dominated sort of world? What are some of the issues that
I was reflecting on this over the weekend, and one of the things that I remember, which I did, one of the recruitment exercises that I undertook many moons ago, interviewing a recently married young lady into a management position, she said, I will take the job as long as my safety is guaranteed, because I have to work late. And if my soon-to-be employer guarantees the fact that if I have to leave the office at 8 o'clock at night or much later, I have a sense of security that I can reach home safely, which is something that I had not thought of until she mentioned it. I mean, that's just one of the things that women think about, to say, if I'm going to leave the office at 9 or 10 to be competitive, if my male peers tend to stay longer, am I safe leaving the office by myself and going home? You know, so those are the soft things or soft issues that business might consider as soft, but it is actually pretty critical. The second thing is the salary parity.
That awkward moment of salary parity. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about that for a moment.
Yeah. Mail and Guardian stated in August 2015 that South African gender pay gap is estimated on average to be between 15 and 17%. So male colleagues tend to get paid 15 or 17% more than their female colleagues who are doing the same job.
That's month and a half?
That's a month and a half.
So women have to work an extra month and a half in the year to get equal pay to men?
Yes.
Or men get to take a month and a half's holiday?
Yeah. I just want to quote this paragraph that I picked up from the UN Women Report 2015 to 2016. It goes like, women make contributions to economies from the local to the global that amount into trillions of dollars. Despite this fact, women in all regions continue to be overrepresented in low-paid and vulnerable jobs. At the current rate, it will take 70 years to close the gender pay gap. In addition, shouldering the bulk of unpaid care work limits women's opportunities. So I think that's food for thought to show that it's not just a South African thing, it's a global thing. The UN Women Report of 2015-2016 also confirms that. So the pay gap issue is not just a South African thing.
Mm. Now, earlier on, I was having a conversation outside, and one of the things that was raised is when we do these sort of analysis, is it always an accurate analysis once we start doing averages? Because we start getting different professions into the space. So an example was used. You know, if you were to look at, engineers potentially, and let's say the scientific environment that have generally tended to be more male-dominated environments and the salaries that are paid in that environment, and you then average that with, say, perhaps social sciences where they tend to be more women, but the salary bands and the roles in those sort of environments are lower than in the engineering fraternity, for example. If you now start doing averages on all these different numbers, are you not biasing these sort of samples and measurements purely because of how we do that sampling? If we go for a like-for-like comparison, I mean, if I take, and I mean, let me take my own business, for example. We've never, ever had an environment in 7 years where somebody has turned around to us and said, well, I'm prepared to pay X rand for a male qualified chartered accountant, but I'm only prepared to pay, 90% or 80% of that for an equivalent in a woman. Maybe I don't experience it in my own business because it's at the high end of the professional services space. But do people actually do that to women in the workplace, where they go, hold on, this job, because you're a woman, I'm going to pay you, 10% less? I mean, do they practically do that?
I will respond on my executive experience.
Yes, experience.
I have not had to do that. Mm-hmm. And I suppose having been an executive in business as a woman, I would probably support my own. But I think it also goes to the fact that women haven't been in executive roles or in most roles for the longest time.
Yeah.
So society has somehow taken that for granted that it should not necessarily be. And unfortunately for women who come into the workspace, men have been there much longer. So one can always argue, and I'm not trying to generalize here, as you rightly say, it can always be argued that this person has been on the job for 2 years before you, therefore we will start you at a lower bend.
Mm.
Having said that, I think it's equally important for us as women to be able to stand on our own and showcase that we are equally, because it's not just about you are getting paid so much because you're a woman. It's about competence. It's about being able to do the job. And it's also being able to stand your right as a person and a woman in that order in order for you to earn what you qualify for.
Richard, can I just jump in here, because that's a very sensitive question. Do people still do this? I actually think we wouldn't be having this conversation to begin with if this wasn't the case. 3 weeks ago, we had, I think, four women, powerful women in the studio here, one of which was Funeka Monjane from Standard Bank.
Yeah.
And she went further to talk about the fact that there's also the racial dynamic. Mm-hmm. You not only a woman, but you're also a black woman, you know. So there's an added burden from a racial dimension that we also need to look into in terms of how skewed the corporate space is, you know. And I had a conversation, in fact, last week, and we'll be uploading this podcast, where one woman also reflected on the fact that business or the corporate space was created by men, and it still serves men. So there has to be a fundamental mindset shift. And I think women would contribute a great deal, those who have broken the ceiling, who now are in the positions of influence to make decisions, to push for, you know, ways and means to make to right these wrongs. You know, because I don't understand why, if a woman is doing the same job or even has better qualifications, there has to now be an issue as to where do we fit her gender relative to pay.
Can I add to that with some form of a self-disclosure? In one of the businesses that I co-own, my partner happens to be a white male. Lovely person. I shall not mention their name, and I shall not even disclose the business for obvious reasons. And I find that whenever we are in our management meetings with the team that we manage, he has gotten so used to being the one that is in charge. I chair that portfolio, but I have to remind him that I am the one that needs to lead this. But because this person for the longest time has been, as he rightly says, that, you know, business is about, has been set up for men, it takes a while for men to appreciate the input that we bring into the business. And the sad reality is that then those women who are in those positions end up coming across as quite alpha females in order to assert themselves for our male partners to actually acknowledge that, actually, guess what? We are equal partners in this relationship. And what we can only do, which would be best for the business, would be to complement each other. And it's something that needs to be somehow unlearned.
Just to Alice's point, do women who break through the ceiling and sit at those levels, do they, what was your point, do they actually fight it, give back, reach down?
Create an enabling environment. Obviously, you know, you still have the kind of men that you just referred to deal with. But I think once you have those executive powers, the hope is amongst women that at least I've spoken to is that, you know, women are better placed to understand and appreciate the predicament that other women still face, therefore are in a better position to deal with the obstacles.
It's the same with employment equity. If you're a black executive, you've cracked it and you're one of the few up there, then what's the expectation down there of what you're going to do to make it easier for things to be more, for there to be more parity? So do women actually do their part? Or do they forget that they have to now create an enabling environment now that they're up there?
Women do their part. Men do their part, but not all women do their part as much as not all men do their part.
Yeah.
And this is not a diplomatic response. It's as up. It's as bold as it is. You know, there are women who really bend over backwards to bring others up, and there are a few who are comfortable being the only ones in the boardroom. You know, but I mean, we can quote a number of women. I mean, there are names that come to mind. People like Wendy Luhabe have fought hard to ensure, and there's a whole lot of African women in South Africa who are ensuring that those who come after them get to be given an opportunity or better opportunities for that matter. And then again, the horror stories of those. And I suppose the same applies to men. This is not just about women. It's about being either be in business, in corporate, whichever workspace it is, where you either have people who care about development of others and those that are happier just being the best thing since sliced bread.
Just riding with the status quo.
Now, interestingly,
because it works well for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Interestingly, I mean, I listen to you talk and I think to myself, I've often considered myself somebody that doesn't really concern myself too much with who's on the other side in terms of, is it a man or a woman? You know, what color are they? Can we do the job together? Let's get this done. But perhaps as well, it also calls, and maybe I'm being brought to account here, to think a little as somebody in a position of control or power on a number of elements, to say to yourself, okay, so now how do I drive the right outcome here in terms of, you know, so if there is the opportunity to bring a woman to the table, for example, what do I actively do? Because I may not stand in the way, but am I doing something proactively to bring that person to the table? And that's an interesting question, is what, you know, so, I mean, I guess the question would be, what could business owners out there do more of, Kumo, to get women to engage with their businesses more actively, particularly in the recruitment side? How do they go out there and find those really unique, special people to help them move their business forward?
Can I just jump in here? Because from a practical standpoint, you know, I've had the management position where I've had to deal with some of these issues, where I kept wishing that, you know, a woman would step up into the plate, you know, so that at some point, you know, they could come and occupy the same seat that I heard, because I just felt that it's the right thing that must happen. But I figured that it's a two-way process. I could push it as much as, you know, I think it's possible, but if there's no reciprocity,
reciprocity
from the other side, then the process, you know, stops. Because either the person will say, you know, but I just don't feel qualified to be in this position, and then comes in, you know, the upbringing, the background, you know, how the person perceives their capabilities relative to what they think is expected of them, you know. So I think we also have to look at this being a two-way process in terms of, you know, creating that enabling environment.
Agreed. I mean, I think that one has to be in control of one's own brand, as well as knowing who you are in that position. It could be general management, it could be executive position, it could be anything. Just knowing who you are, because you cannot expect other people to know who you are if you don't know who you are, in order for them to assist you. And I think that applies to everybody. It's not just about women having to know who they are. You know, you, Richard, you mentioned in your space, in your business space, you don't notice it and that you do it differently. But perhaps you're present to it. Some people are not doing it in bad faith, but it's because they have been institutionalized, because they've been socialized. So it's become institutionalized in the way they deal with business or with any person in the work realm, and especially women in this case.
Now, if I can just ask you one, and maybe flip this scenario around, because I did find back in my days in the corporate world, I had particular roles that I realized women were just really good at. And I actually went out of my way to create all-women teams, for example, undertaking a certain type of activity, because they were just better at it than men were. And, you know, I kind of sit here and think to myself, well, was I replacing one kind of prejudice with another? I guess in a way, you know, at the time, you know, everybody used to joke. They used to say, "Here comes Richard and his 13 power women," because it was a team of 13 ladies at the time who were involved in a certain part of our process in the business. And boy, I think there were many men who ran for cover when those ladies walked into the room, because they were really knowledgeable, they knew the business well, they had great insights, and they really, really managed to move things forward fundamentally. And, you know, the team just worked, and it was a team of women, and I left it like that because I thought that was a good thing. Does that all women team crack squad really work out there? Does that sort of approach work?
I'm amused at what you've just said, because it suggests that you were pleasantly surprised that the all-women team, and I think herein lies the issue that we are discussing, that, you know, we are so socialized into thinking, if it's women, it's not going to be good enough, and therefore we're pleasant. It's almost like you're pleasantly surprised.
I think my point was, I think a lot of people outside of my
expected
business.
Expected it to be.
No. I think they were more. When I say they were very wary of the team because they knew this group of women had a reputation in the industry as being top performers, a top team. They dealt with professionals in the industry, and they really, really had good reputations. And I kind of had gone out of my way to make sure that I had this top team. And my logic was simply, these are good people. They are recognized as being really good at what they do, and I want the best team available. And so, sorry, it doesn't have a man in the team. Sorry, I can't help you. If I don't have any top men that can fit the bill, well, sorry, guys, you have to step out. The women have got this one sorted, done and dusted.
Yeah,
I think those are folks who have obviously not watched the 4x4 Olympics team by the Jamaican women. Women do work best together. Mm. But again, I mean, I think she's right. The sort of conditioning that we all...
Mm.
Is in us, you know. We kind of have to find a way to break through that, to look at the person's competency and capabilities. You know, it's whether the person can get the job done. Gender is irrelevant.
It's and make no mistake, I knew that team would execute for me flawlessly every time without fail. It was the one part of my operational team that I knew was rigged for success, and I didn't even have to, you know, lead that team. I could just give them the occasional, you know, insight and inspiration, and off they went. They were really well led and really well executed.
Well, at the end of this year, by the end of November, the world might be faced with three of the most powerful economies led by women, and I think that's food for thought.
What are you saying about Donald? Only kidding.
She will do a good job.
Well, I know where you're going. I just couldn't resist that one.
No. Go ahead.
No, it's fine. I mean, I think it's interesting that you mentioned the politics. You know, potentially even here, you're hearing that a woman should be put forward to lead and potentially lead this country. So, I mean, at the end of the day, I think we need to address the root causes of what, you know, brings us to these sort of conversations. You know, I've got a 16-month-old daughter, and I wish for her, and I want for her a much more different world than the kind of world that, you know, women today are still confronted to, or that my mother, you know, was confronted with.
Can I just come in here? I mean, this is not about business, but at the moment, the last year in South Africa especially, we've had the Fees Must Fall movement, and we have had at universities students going on to, you, for lack of a better word, rampage because of sexual harassment of women on campuses. And, you know, Rhodes University is one and a few other universities. So, but the point is, how is it that we still, in this day and age, have to actually fight so hard for issues like sexual harassment, that those things have been in the book of laws to say sexual harassment is outlawed, for lack of a better word, but we still are grappling with those things, which by definition confirms what he's saying, that, you know, we've been so conditioned that, you know, women should be harassed. And I'm not saying that men have not been harassed, but most of the time you find that in situations like that, it's women or girls who have been experiencing the harassment, not just the sexual harassment, and any other form of harassment for that matter.
Interesting point. I'm sitting here wondering what is being done by way of lobbying to bring equality back to remuneration between men and women, while we're just letting society correct it by itself.
I don't think society is ever going to correct that. So there has to be a carrot and a stick approach. I mean, we see with the boards that are there at this point that, you know, that isn't happening. I mean, even if you have a female CEO, I mean, in the banking sector, for example, I mean,
how's APSA's
disparity?
Team?
There's disparity. Richard can speak to this.
Yeah.
What does APSA's executive team look like?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think for me, the interesting scenario starts playing out, for example, when you've got publicly disclosed remuneration, like, you know, annual financial statements of a bank, and then you compare...
There's probably parity there, if you ask me.
Or well, you start comparing, and remember, I mean, there is also, you know, parity is a very difficult word to use, because, you know, does Standard Bank's CEO and First Rand CEO and Absa CEO and Nedbank CEO, should they all be remunerated the same? Because the reality is they're not. And whether they're men or women is irrelevant. They are not remunerated equally. So it's always difficult to see, you know, within the nuances there, you know, is, you know, Maria actually not getting paid what she should because she's a woman, or because, you know, APSA's
what
not,
APSA does, yeah.
Or it's APSA's paying what it's paying. Mm. So you've always got the organizational, let's call it shift, that's an issue. But I do think the reality is that as more disclosure happens at various levels, and I mean, you know, there's a push around executive disclosure, you know, and remuneration disclosure of executives, etc. I mean, let's take, for example, a non-executive director, a female non-executive director sitting on a board of a company. It's now very easy to see what that person is earning relative to her male non-executive counterparts, mm. who are effectively sitting in the same board meetings with the same set of information, being expected to make the same sort of decisions. Now, there you start seeing some real questions around parity and the likes. And interestingly, in that space, my experience is the remuneration is identical.
Yeah.
Because the remuneration and governance structures say we pay X Rand for contribution, and it's contribution based and time based contribution rather than and expertise based. And basically, if you tick the box as being capable of being a non-exec director, everybody's happy. But I think, you know, that there's a level of transparency there that forces that that accountability.
Okay, so does that transparency then dissipate as you move to the lower tiers?
I think it probably does.
Of the organizations,
it does.
Which
yeah.
for us, I think that's where the crux of the problem is.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the revised BEE codes, mm-hmm. especially in relation to issues of ownership, I mean, black women ownership is encouraged. And I mean, I'm just responding to your issue about have the carrot and the stick thing. Mm. Carrot and stick. Whether that piece of legislation that has now been revised, is it going to be the carrot and stick? Is it going to actually get the issues that we're discussing to actually be resolved? Mm. I think the parity of pay issue is something that is going to be debated for the longest of times.
Mm.
I don't think it's just about women and males. Mm. It's just that at this point in time, we're discussing, you know, the gender parity.
Isn't the simplicity, those who are in power don't just hand it over? Whether it's political, business, gender, race, it doesn't matter. You know, people who are in power don't just hand over. There's always a obvious or less obvious resistance that comes into the picture. And that's probably universally so.
Mm.
And therefore, we'll always be debating these issues.
I suppose it's also about leadership. I mean, when you say people in power, I mean, you're either a leader or you're not a leader. I mean, a good leader will deal with those issues. And a person who is in a leadership position and they're there for the power issue, they're going to continue.
Okay, now how are we doing on good leadership in the world in general? Thumbs down. You know, leadership in general is in dire straits. Crisis. Well, so we will be debating this for a long time
exactly.
to come.
But at least we are debating it, which is good.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's wrap up. Thank you so much, Kumar, for joining us. I don't know if you're staying on, but we're going to SME interview. And, you know, interesting, we've got our Tsogo Sun Entrepreneurs competition with 5 finalists that have been named, and in a month or two they will have a winner as well at some fancy dinner. And I think I'm going to be there. I look forward to it. I was part of the judging panel. Stay with us. Next up, we will interview one of those finalists.
This is CliffCentral.com.